So that was the Captain Stansberry Interpretive Trail on Stansberry Island. Pretty neat. So as you're driving back, enjoy levels. Now, you don't have to memorize stuff, although I find that I do memorize some things. So by elevation, the levels are the very highest, Bonneville, that's as high as it got. It's an open lake. It was a ice age lake. It was a freshwater lake. It had fish. You would have had saber-toothed kittens coming down and playing on shore. Huge mammoths, major bears, sloths that would just make your mother proud. Anyway, then the next one down is Provo. Provo level also was an open system. It was a freshwater lake. It wasn't quite as fresh in this part of the lake because of complications. It's a little bit like the north arm, south arm of Great Salt Lake, Gilbert Bay, Gunnison Bay. For some of the time, the evaporation in this main body was so much that it actually wasn't a freshwater lake in just Cache Valley. It was a freshwater lake. But that's a digression. So as you're driving back, you'll see those two big ones and try to spot them no matter where you are. Try to spot them in Wendover. I think you'll be tricked thinking that the Provo's the Bonneville. I always get tricked out there, but I think we'll see if you do. I'm looking at the Lakeside Mountains, which I spot by the U.S. Magnesium plant on the far side. And I look over there and I just say to myself, I can spot Bonneville because it hasn't been flooded above that. I have to let my eyes swing left and right. I don't just try to figure it out in one spot. And then I find Provo is the really big one. And then the one that's about halfway down from Provo is the Stansberry, and it's subtle because it was on the way up. So you're probably going to have trouble spotting the Stansberry, but every time you do, give yourself a gold star. And how you know that it was the Stansberry on the way up is that in some drainages, you'll see the beach deposits, and then you'll see the lake deposits across them. So if you saw the lake deposits and then the shoreline deposits, you'd say, well, that's kind of out of order. I first have to get the beach here, and then I can put the lake sediments across that. Did you follow that? In other words, if you were to go to a lake today, you'd go across some sands and gravels, and then you'd walk into the lake, and you get all those muds that are on the bottom. But underneath those muds are where the transgressive, meaning the shore that was coming up, is underneath. So anyway, this is a bit heavy, but so you've got in order Bonneville, Provo, Stansberry. And then there's no better place, I think, to see evidence of the two shorelines of Great Salt Lake than on Antelope Island and Stansberry Island. And that's because they're kind of like dipsticks. They just sit in the middle of the lake and they get the whole record. So as we're driving back, I'm seeing this level that's maybe 20, 30. It's a shoreline up there. And you say, but there are a couple of them. I see one that's maybe 40, 50. So these are levels of Great Salt Lake. So once again, Lake Bonneville's the Ice Age Lake. Great Salt Lake is the inner glacial, global glacial times, climate like ours. And so let's take a look at Great Salt Lake. So people have been in Utah probably for almost the whole time the Great Salt Lake has been here. So as soon as ice ages are over, we seem to have the possibility of people being in Utah. But most of them did not write history. And it really isn't until the 1860s and 70s that we have written observations, consistent monitoring of Great Salt Lake. Jim Bridger was apparently the first white man to recognize Great Salt Lake, and he'd have done that, I think, in the 1840s, early 40s. And Father Escalante and Dominguez heard about the lake, but they did not come from Utah Lake and see it. So they relied on Native Americans' versions of what the white folks understood. I'm not saying that well, but I think there's a lot of miscommunication. And I think the Native Americans were very aware of lakes because lakes were really such an important part of their diet. No, they didn't eat the lake, but they ate the birds that were along the lake. And you can be sure that they were very aware of fluctuations of the lake. And I think, personally, that when people heard that, they said that, no, they say the Indians say that the lake went west. Well, I think sometimes the lake did go west, just the way it did in the 1980s when we pumped it there, but it could naturally go there during the time that people had been here, and I think it would have been an impressive sight, and I, you know, but that's my talking. Anyway, Great Salt Lake has been here for about 12,000 years, and we know that people have been here certainly for on the order of 10, perhaps work it back from there. So what do we see here? We see sand dunes. I tend to see them on the lake side of the road. We see sand dunes. Other evidence of today's climate would be the quote-unquote alluvial fans that are flash flood deposits that come out of the canyons. Stansbury Island doesn't have very big watersheds. So compared to the Stansbury Mountains, we really don't have very big alluvial fans here, but we have some. And so what do I notice about them? I notice that they come out, they're on the east side of the road, and they tend to sort of bring materials right across the terrain. And in some of these areas, it's been mined. And when you see these mined out areas, sometimes it's a bit of a vision that you can look in there and you can see the layering of the lake beds. Gotta be kind of aware here. And you can see that the flash flood deposits come across them. You can also, I'm in a place that I can see the levels as they just march upwards. And then I can see where they've been cut by drainages of today. So today's climate is characterized by many years that are drier and warmer than those that are really wet. And we have cold winters. We're called a cold desert environment. I also want you to see and not be confused by the bedrock layering. So right next to it, you have the gray and you have the white. And you say to yourself, Genevieve, we can handle it. Tell us about the past. Tell us about that white and about that gray. I love that white stripe. It was a beach back in the age of fishes. It's not the white stripe of Antelope Island. And in fact, why don't I talk to you about why this island is here and what its bedrock is all about and how we try to figure it out. So as a sweeping generalization, the gray rocks are what are called limestones, meaning they were laid down and those tend to be layered. They were layered initially horizontally. And you look off to the east and you say, things are very messy. The white stripe was beach deposits. And we kind of know that because it's sand that's turned into quartzite. So, and do try to driver's drive as we vaguely meandered as my driver was very interested in watching. So driver's drive, okay? So notice off to the left what a mess it is. So the layers here, gray ones, started out horizontal and the beaches arrived first and then across them came the gray layers. Okay, we're okay on that and they were horizontal. But what has happened to them since? Notice that the ones on the very top of the island are horizontal, but they look like exactly the same rocks as the ones that are tilted down below. And notice that they look as if there's just a whack. So I'm looking, there's a little water tank, and then up high on the ridge, there's white that I can see is layered almost horizontal. And then to the south of that, it's tilted, drama. And then it just looks as if it's whacked off with the gray layers running right into it. And down below here, and you say, what has happened? Yeah. So intuitively, you're using patterns to figure out the changes. Because what has happened here are the two biggest, boldest, baddest rules of figuring out older than, younger than relationships. That's called relative age. So just humor me for a moment. Assume that the white rocks are the oldest, and they were horizontal, almost horizontal, way back when, age of fishes. And then across them came the gray rocks, and they were layers, and those were horizontal. Well, something major must have happened between those age of fishes and today. And it's called the age of the dinosaurs, and it's scrunching swamps in Utah. So what those gray and white rocks are telling us today is that Utah was really near, relatively near sea level, because that's a beach, and relatively near warm waters, because we find fossils in there that are corals and brachiopods and the kinds of things that like warm water, back when they were laid down horizontally. And then they got buried and buried and buried. And then much later, like a couple hundred million years later, that's a lot of time, this area didn't look like that. And in fact, we were in the bowels of a mountain range. And this is not the mountain range of the Wasatch. And I'll get back to why we don't think that. But this was a mountain range that during dinosaur times was as high as the Himalayas. It actually, the better analogy is the Andes. Compressional tectonics were such that the Rocky Mountains mass, the thickness of the Rocky Mountains, was being scrunched. Because Western North America, what is now Western North America, was being sort of moving west and moving east on the margin were island arcs that continued to get accreted, meaning added onto the North American continent. And after a couple million years, you got Oregon and Washington and parts of California added onto the North American continent. What they say about Oregon is they say, Oregon, some assembly required, you know, like opening one of your toys at Christmas. So during that time, this region looked the way the Andes do today, just as high, just as impressive, and within those mountain ranges, these rocks that had been horizontal got folded, tilted, and some of them actually slid across each other from west to east. We can kind of put it back together again to see where they came from. And some of them came, you know, 20, 30 miles from the west and slid across. And some of you may actually have your imagination see these. So how do I use my imagination to see them? What I do is I look for the tilted gray rocks. It's nice when things are color coordinated, isn't it? And then I look at the white rocks. And I say to myself, did those white rocks slide right across those gray rocks? I sometimes don't answer it easily, but when you have the drama of white versus gray, you can really get a sense that during mountain building, these rocks were bendable, they were foldable, and they could move as sheets across each other. Now, one of the things about, so we think about Earth's crust as being thick because it protects us from what's hot underneath us. But it really isn't that thick. It's like the skin of an apple. And the forces that are driven by, you know, it goes crust, mantle, core. The circulation patterns of the mantle actually move the crust. The big movements are the plate movements, but within those plate movements, there are scrunches where it's compressional and extensions where it's extensional, meaning stretching where it's extensional. And the stretching really is along faults. So then we come to the present. I think you can see that the shorelines that are so visible for us today that are cut into and laid across those rocks up there, those tilted rocks, those rocks had to be there, and they had to be tilted before those ones that are laid across it are there, right? So Lake Bonneville is lots, lots, lots younger than the folding and tilting and scrunching. So let me walk through Utah's past as 9 chapters, because some of you will be your scientists and be interested in it. Now, if you lived in China, you'd have a whole different series of China history than you would have if you lived in Paris or than if you lived in the United States. So know this is Utah's story in 9 chapters. So underneath it all is the bedrock. And that's chapter 1. And it is metamorphic. And Stansbury Island was not here then, and the rocks of Stansbury Island were not here then. Chapter 2 are the rocks that we see up Big Cottonwood Canyon, and we call them metamorphism light. And those were a couple billion years ago, at least a billion years ago. And the rocks of Stansbury Island weren't here, and Stansbury Island as a feature wasn't here. Then in Chapter 3 and Chapter 4, we have the seas come in and the seas come out, and we get some broad basins. Those are the rocks of Stansbury Island, but we still didn't have Stansbury Island per se. And then in Chapter 5, instead of being at the equator and south of the equator, we were actually rising. We were rising because of tectonics. Tectonics rules everything. And by Chapter 6, it was scrunch and swamps. This region looked like the Andes, and off to the east of us were the swamps that are kind of like today's Amazon, but they were back then, and that's what brings us the coal of Carbon County and eastern Utah. So, that's it. Then in Chapter 7, the whole region went up a mile, so we were as high as the Tibetan Plateau, and in Chapter 8, we had voluminous volcanics and impressive igneous. We got the hot bodies of Bingham Copper Mine. It's cooled off a bit. We got the volcanics that we see in various places in Utah, particularly in the Sevier River area of Marysvale and Richfield. And in Chapter 9, instead of being in a compressional environment, we're in an extensional environment. And in that process, we get the basins and ranges. So once again, the rocks of Stansbury Island were laid down here in Chapters 3 and 4 about 300 million years ago. They were scrunched about 90 million years ago, but they were not anywhere near the surface then. And we had the rocks of Stansbury Island, but we didn't have Stansbury Island. In fact, we don't get Stansbury Island until Chapter 9, about 22,000 years ago. Extensional tectonics started to break up the basins and ranges. By 5 million years ago, you probably would have seen Stansbury Island and most of the ranges of the basin and range, sort of where you expect to see them now. By 4 million years ago, we start going into global climate change, global interglacial, global glacial, global interglacial, global glacial. And then just by 30,000 years ago, which is nothing in geologic time, we have Lake Bonneville begin to go up at 15,000 years ago, and it's its highest, and now we're back to now, and I think that's the whole story of 4.7 billion years in about 4.7 minutes. So I'll let you enjoy what you see here. I'll interrupt myself in a bit. We're at one of the big quarries. I think this is the one that was for Kennecott, but ahead of us we see the Stansbury Mountains. I can see those steps rising, rising, rising. Actually, I'll keep on talking because one of the questions sometimes people have is, what is the relationship between Antelope Island and Stansbury Island? Well, as features, they're the same age. They're both ranges of the basin and range. You could have started to recognize them, 5-10 million years ago. As the stretching continues, the ranges stay high and the basins drop, so we keep drowning Antelope Island and Stansbury Island by sediments that fill in, because this is the low place and sediments fill in. But the rocks of Stansbury and Antelope Island are totally different ages. And after I gave that whole history to you, you just shouldn't let that worry you. So try when you're teaching to distinguish between the age of the feature versus the age of its rocks. almost always a feature is older than what it's made of. There's some exceptions. There are volcanoes and there, you know, even things like a shoreline. But when you're dealing with bedrock, you can be sure in Utah that if it's a bedrock feature, unless it's a volcano, the feature is young, but the bedrock is old. Oh, did I say that wrong? The rocks are old, bedrock is old, and the feature is young. I hope I said that right this time. And gosh, we're coming back at around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, almost 5, and we are seeing shorelines everywhere. So we're proceeding south, and we're seeing Tooele Valley. And so let your bright eyes spot Bonneville features. So straight south of us is South Mountain, and I see the Bonneville shoreline. Driver, do you see the Bonneville shoreline? Sure, it's been flooded below and not flooded above. And the feature that's immediately east of it is called the Stockton Bar, and that is the highest level of Lake Bonneville, the Bonneville level, and it's composite. It really gives the history of what it was like in terms of fluctuations at the Bonneville level. And then I look off to the west, and I'm also able to spot the highest level because it looks not flooded above and flooded below. So that's using patterns as your friends. You can use the patterns of vegetation. I think I can really tell sort of where the Great Salt Lake level has been, including up to the Gilbert level, by some of the scruffy sagebrush and rabbitbrush that we're seeing, and certainly by any of the sort of beach deposits and windblown sand dunes. So trust your eyes in terms of patterns. I'm finding it good discipline to think about the five subsystems of Earth systems: the geosphere, hydrosphere, atmosphere, biosphere, anthrosphere, and try to deliberately see patterns for each. So as I'm looking towards the ochres, I see patterns of the hydrosphere, meaning I see canyons and I see their relationships with respect to the geosphere. And some canyons are longer than other canyons. We call some of those quarter canyons half canyons, but there really isn't a full canyon that goes through the ochres. You might say that Middle Canyon connects with Butterfield Canyon, and it kind of does. So look straight ahead of you, of us now. We're looking at the north end of the Stansbury Mountains, and we're seeing the interaction of the shorelines with the interactions with the canyons. Along the Wasatch Front, we get quote-unquote deltas. There were rivers that were coming into Lake Bonneville carrying sediments. There are rivers that are coming into Great Salt Lake that are carrying sediments, such as the Jordan River, the Bear River, and they create what's called a delta. So a delta is a landform that looks a little bit like the Greek letter delta. It's laid down by water in a stream into quiet water of a lake or even of an ocean. So would you expect to have as many deltas or as big deltas in Tooele County as you would have in, for example, Salt Lake or Utah County? And if your whole career depended on it, where would you look for deltas? And I bet you could find them, even now. Those of you who know Tooele, you know where there are year-round streams. So one of the places I'd look, for example, would be Settlement Canyon. I'd expect to find a delta that was associated with Lake Bonneville when it was wetter and when there was a lot more runoff, including from Settlement Canyon, where it came into Lake Bonneville at Settlement Canyon. Because any stream that was really carrying quite a lot of sediments should have built a delta, unless there were longshore currents or other reasons why they didn't. How about looking at the biota? So the biota is a great clue to the underlying materials. Because in Utah, well, everywhere, most vegetation is challenged either by water or by light. And in Utah, it's pretty much by water. You get enough light for most things to grow, but lots of them don't get the water that they need. So there, it should be no surprise that the sand dunes are going to have different vegetation than, for example, the bedrock. And you might say to yourself, can I actually see some of the difference between what was under Lake Bonneville by the grasses that I'm seeing as we're driving along versus, well, the grasses above as well. But I certainly see a big difference between just the consistency of vegetation and the patterns of vegetation below the Bonneville level of Lake Bonneville than above it. And then we have the anthrosphere, which are people. In Salt Lake County, for example, it's been zoning that folks aren't meant to build above the Bonneville level. There are a few reasons for that. A, it's a lot steeper. And B, if they built above the Bonneville level, we've got to get them some water. And if we get them water to drink, we also have to get them water to fight fires. And so to get the infrastructure above the Bonneville level costs more. And usually it's the public that's paying for that. Well, occasionally it's the developers. Much less often it's the individuals. And so there isn't much development above the Bonneville level of Lake Bonneville, unless, of course, you're a ski resort or something that's totally different. So that's the way I look for patterns. I try to look for what I see, or what, to be deliberate, sort of routine and discipline, because it's so easy for me to not pay attention if I go through the list. Patterns. Now, there are other cross-cutting relationships that we'll be teaching as teachers now that we have the new science framework. There's seven of these cross-cutting concepts, and I'll talk to you about them because I think they're so wonderful. Usually when we're teaching, we only want to use a few of them, maybe just one. Almost always with earth science, you can do patterns. The second one is cause and effect. And cause and effect, just, I wish you could see me, because I raise my arm like the Statue of Liberty, and I want everyone in my class to say tectonics rules. Because cause and effect, don't think about earth processes without in the back of your mind saying, is there a difference in elevation? Is there some form of energy associated with potential energy that leads to kinetic energy? Is there a reason that a system has the energy that it has? And it almost always goes back to tectonics. Tectonics determines whether something is high or low. And as we've probably discussed in class, this whole region was way high before the spreading of the basin and range. So all we have to do is drop the basins. We don't have to keep lifting the mountain ranges. All right, so that's the second. So we have patterns, cause and effect. The next one has to do with scale, proportion, and quantity. And I think even today with the model, where we had a kinesthetic model that was very small, in terms of short would be a better word, and small, compared to the physical model of Lake Bonneville. So we walked 100 feet to represent 1,000 years. We went, I think it was up on the order of 4 or 5 feet in order to represent 100 feet of elevation change. So that would be considered a model, a scale and model. The fourth one is energy and matter. And is it systems and system flows?
Systems and
system models. Okay. And we did a model today. And then the fifth one is energy and matter, flows, conservation, and cycles. So when we think about energy, think about wave processes. We're coming on a day that's very windy, and there are actually little bits of foam that are being blown across the road, I did my dissertation on Antelope Island, looking at the shorelines and trying to figure out if it was possible to figure out which way the wind was blowing during Lake Bonneville time. And you'd say, why would we want to know that? Because we want to know it. Anyway, so, and part of that had to do with shoreline evidence, because you saw a lot of trash as we went around on the trail of Stansbury Island. And part of my dissertation looked at Stansbury Island as well. So, 6 is structure and function. Basically, the structure of basins and ranges make them either terrific or not so good for urban development. And the stability and change, that's just such an important one, particularly with respect to climate change.